My name is Peter Strum, and I'm a pastor at First Lutheran in Duluth, and my function here tonight will be to moderate the forum, and the topic being, should the ELCA ordain practicing homosexuals? Now, I know that this particular issue has not necessarily emerged from discussion within this community within the last few days or weeks, but it certainly is a live issue, and this was shown in a few weeks ago, a coalition of 50 ELCA clergy and laity from a number of congregations in the San Francisco area have made it clear that they intend to ordain one of the three young men that was that were rejected by the bishops in California solely on the issue that they were homosexuals who would not say that they would be celibate. And so they've said, we will ordain probably one of these three and call them, even though it's against ELCA policy. And this, in a sense, forces a showdown. Now, however that resolves is probably beside the point. I think it's clear that this issue is more likely to be to get hotter over the coming months and years than it is to recede, at least in my opinion. And as a pastor, I have found that there are some issues that seem almost too hot to discuss within the context of a congregation. This issue came up about 4 years ago in Duluth, and I thought there was far more heat than light shed on it. And it seemed as though one could hardly articulate a position but what you were accused of a whole bunch of other stuff. And as Mark pointed out in one of his presentations today, true community needs to have conflict, but conflict handled in a healthy way in which one can air one's views. And one of the benefits, of course, of that is that not only is there some clarity gained, but as one of the philosophers he pointed out in the Renaissance said, if you end up in a discussion where you come to the conclusion that your viewpoint was wrong, you really are the winner because you ended up gaining something that you didn't have before your discussion. And I would hope that the tone of the discussion tonight would certainly recognize that I assume there are going to be people with differing positions on this issue. And for that reason, Dorothy Bass and Rob Wall have consented to give positions, one for and one against, the ordination of homosexuals, just as grist for the mill. And then opening it up to discussion a little bit later on, I'd like to call on Peter Stanky, who does a lot of counseling with clergy, for some of his perspective on some of the practical implications of this. And hopefully by the end of the hour, there will not have been a resolution by any means, but I always gain, and I'm sure that you feel the same way, they always gain from hearing a well-articulated position, and then maybe even going up against it, and then coming away, maybe having thought through more clearly what the issue is. Before I call on Rob, I would like to just outline very briefly a schema of James Nelson, who was the ethics professor at United Theological Seminary in Brighton, Minnesota. And he has said that there have been four ethical positions of Christians towards homosexual people, gay and lesbian people. One, he says, is rejecting and punitive. Now, there may be many Christian people that are still into this position, but there is no official denominational body that would be. So we'll eliminate that as probably part of this community. The second is rejecting of homosexual, but non-punitive. In other words, saying, and you want to hear sometimes some churches saying, love the reject the sin and love the sinner. This was articulated in a manner by Karl Barth, and it basically argues from nature saying this is not the intent and will of the created order, but that this idea of being punitive is just abhorrent to the Christian faith, and we have to move past that. A modification of that by Helmut Thielicke and others is what's called qualified acceptance, which I think would probably reflect the ELCA position. Qualified acceptance takes into account the amount of the sociological and psychological research that demonstrates that sexual orientation is rarely chosen and often occurs at, it's a, certainly a mystery, but is often formed in kind of pre-conscious levels. And yet it still maintains that it somehow violates the created order. So the position is it is a reflection of the brokenness in the world, but let's not single out this brokenness over anybody any other brokenness. And yet you still say, can a person practice be a practicing homosexual and be a pastor? And then the answer is no. The final position is full acceptance, and this basically says you can't argue that from nature that a sexual orientation is good or bad. It's gay, lesbian people are, you might call a minority report, neither better nor worse, and therefore this should not be an issue. Most of the biblical material was culturally conditioned. There isn't much anyway. One can certainly get by that, and let's get past some of our old views and full acceptance. And I think this would be reflective of the position taken by the congregations and clergy in the Bay Area. The implications of that would be many, and certainly one of the things that they would argue is what is wrong with ordaining a gay or lesbian person into the ministry and having them marry. Now, one thing I want to say is not an issue in this forum, and that is the question that so oftentimes gets lobbed into the debate on an emotional level. That is where people start talking about some of the stereotypes of homosexual behavior, and oftentimes they include homosexual rape and child abuse, etc. Nobody is taking the position, that that is a moral behavior, and that's a very unfair thing to put on gay and lesbian people. That's been shown again and again by study after study. That's unfair, and that's not an issue. What's at issue is it permissible within the Christian community for there to be a committed, faithful, loving relationship between people of the same sex? And in the diversity of the community, as Rob was speaking of, can there be this diversity too? Or does one cross the line and get beyond the Christian witness in some way to do that? Rob has consented, not necessarily reflecting his own views, but to try to give a position against, or I suppose in favor of the current ELCA position.
As I understand it, the position is that homosexual believers can be, or I'm going to put it in a positive way, homosexual believers can be ordained to Christian ministry on the condition that they refrain from homosexual practices. Now, such a position, it seems to me, assumes three different convictions. First of all, it assumes that homosexuality is inherently evil, that it does no good to talk about various kinds of homosexual relationships. Homosexuality is inherently evil because it violates God's created good. The second conviction that this position assumes, and I'm going to try to be as brief as I can. Peter suggested 5 minutes. That's
That's hard, but I'm going to try and work with it. The second conviction, it seems to me, is that homosexuals do not choose homosexuality freely and deliberately. Rather, it is a sexual orientation that has been perverted by one's participation in a surrounding social order with which itself is perverting and fallen and corrupting. So that in this sense, homosexuality is caused and not chosen. This seems to be significant in that homosexuals then are not in active rebellion against God. Their sexual orientation is not a deliberate act of rebellion against God's created order. Now this leads, I think, to a third conviction, and that is that homosexuals must choose not to engage then in homosexual acts, even as believers choose to trust in God deliberately and freely. So homosexual believers make a faithful act, that is a free and deliberate choice, not to engage in homosexual acts, even though they are homosexual in orientation. Now, I would take it that a distinction should be made here between celibacy, which is understood as a gift from God, and abstinence, which is understood as a spiritual discipline. It seems to me that to make that third conviction work, you have to make that distinction. It would be unfair to assume that all homosexual believers are celibate by gift of God. The argument works if, in fact, we make a distinction between celibacy and abstinence, where the abstaining from homosexual behavior constitutes an act of faithfulness, a spiritual discipline. Now, the biblical justifications traditionally marshaled to defend that position are two, both from Paul. The first is from, and I think these are probably fairly well-known passages, the first is from Romans chapter 1, beginning at verse 18 through verse 32, and in particular verses 26 and 27. Let me cite those verses, and then I will try to provide a context which might give the traditional meaning of this text. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with other men and receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error. Now, in the context of Romans chapter 1, Paul is rehearsing a rabbinic polemic against paganism. And according to rabbinic teaching, Paul himself, a rabbi, God had been written out of creation by the rebelliousness of God's creatures. Left to itself, a community of rebellious creatures, which make up a corrupting, fallen world, inevitably bear witness to its own separation from God its own need of restoration by the acts of religious and moral and social and political anarchy. One of those evidences of God's judgment, one of the evidences of corruption, is homosexuality. For Paul, that would constitute an act of rebellion against God. But the language of the text would suggest that these acts of anarchy are the natural yield of one's participation in a community, in a world order that stands under the judgment of God. So that idolatry and homosexuality and thievery and other kinds of social and political rebellion are inevitable. This is what a community which stands under the wrath of God must in fact display in its own collective life. Now the other passage, and so Romans 1 would be appealed to, it seems to me, to argue for both the first two convictions. That is, homosexuality is an inherent evil, and yet homosexuals are caused by their participation in a corrupting, perverted, fallen creation. Now the other passage, and I think it's an important passage for making sense of that third conviction, is 1 Corinthians. Oh, is it? Okay. As I was saying, it's hard for me to get under control. Out of my control. Well, let me just... It's easier for me when I move away from that. 1 Corinthians 6 says that those that engage in homosexual acts will not inherit the kingdom of God. And then Paul goes on to say, such as were some of you, in chapter 6, verse 11. And then in chapter 6, 12 through 20, he argues for a theology of the body. And he says the body is the location of God's transforming grace, that the witness to God's transforming grace is bodily, it's public. And how we use our bodies either brings glory or shame to God. Now that theology of the body seems to justify the concern then that homosexual believers, while oriented toward same-gender sexuality, must refrain in any kind of bodily participation or public participation in that. That it is by our bodies that we give witness to our allegiance to God, that we bring glory to God, or that we bring shame to God.
Dorothy? This is an issue that has a very personal human face for me, in that I believe that I know and have known in my 20 years in theological education some dozen or more, two dozen people whom I admire and love very much, men and women, who are homosexual and whom I fully believe with all that I can say are called to Christian ministry. They have experienced in their own lives that what the Reformers call the secret call, that mysterious sense that emerges sometimes as a voice and sometimes as a direction in life, that they are called and intended by God to serve the church in that way. They have all the gifts that I associate and that the church historically has associated with ministry. They are capable of leadership, they are of high moral character, they are able to make commitments and to be loving. They are intellectually capable and theologically sound, okay? And they have a full sense of their own Christian identity in what I consider to be a mature way, if you look at them as total persons. And that's, if I'm honest, those people whom I know and love are the reason that I would take this position tonight. But still, whenever one, especially a church historian, I guess, decides to argue against the weight of custom, tradition, and popular wisdom, you know, you kind of have to come up with reasons as to why that would be. I think there are good reasons. But let me, as I think about what reasons to find, in a sense, one thing that you have to do is to evaluate the source and character of the prejudice against ordination. Okay, what is the source and character of the prejudice against ordination of gay and lesbian people? And then secondly, to ask, okay, then as another question, is this one aspect of a person's being of the sort that draws a definitive line against, I mean, separating that person from all other called and ordained ministers? Okay, so let me take those two questions. One, to examine the source of the prejudice itself. And this isn't exhaustive, but some things that prompt us. It seems to me that throughout the history of the church, Christian people have had the bad habit of confusing their own social and cultural norms with the mandates of Christianity. Okay? The way in which we live in family, the language we speak, the way we hold her utensils, and all these things are very cultural. And because religion pervades our lives and Christianity pervades our lives, sometimes we think that those cultural ways of being are exactly the same as what the Christian life is about. Missionaries have taken that message, that mistaken cultural message, with them in preaching Christianity around the world. I mean, a lot of missionaries have thought that to be Christian meant to become like the Americans, right? And so sometimes our own mores and ethical views, which we assume because there's so much a part of us, are from our religion, are not really, but they're really from other prejudices in the culture. We have to really wonder whether, say, those two passages would mark those as essentially, basically Christian, or whether cultural matters might not be formative on those, on the prejudice itself, more so than theological and biblical matters. And recall that for many centuries in the church, sexuality itself stood under this same kind of cultural judgment. Secondly, as a more psychological point, it seems to me that one of the greatest challenges of every person is to construct and discover a full and mature sexuality. And that this is a difficult matter for almost everyone. I mean, the developmental phases that we go through, the mixed messages that our culture gives us, whatever our orientation, and to be fully confident and mature in one's own sexuality, I think, is a wonderful thing which is not always achieved. And that sometimes people who are different receive prejudice and hostility from us because of that insecurity. Okay. Thirdly, turning to more biblical and theological matters, yes, there are a few biblical texts which condemn the homosexual practices of a certain time and place. But the overall thrust of Lutheran biblical interpretation, as I understand it, is not to make a law of individual texts, okay, not to construct rules out of sayings at every point. There are many, many sayings against divorce, against other remarriage, sometimes women speaking without their heads covered, okay, women speaking at all, witchcraft. And there are all kinds of junk of strictures in the scripture, and you have to ask, why is this one of all of them lifted up so much higher than the others, which we have had very little problem in overcoming. And it seems to me that the central form of Lutheran biblical interpretation would be to look for the gospel, okay, to say that the full revelation is Jesus Christ, okay, as revealed in the, as we know Jesus Christ through the Word, but that the grace and the love of God, which pervades the Scriptures, is really the basic way in which we interpret the rest of the canon. One article on this which I have found very persuasive is by Rosemary Radford Ruther called The Sexuality of Jesus. And she's a theologian, perhaps some of you know her. She looked at how different people through the centuries have looked at Jesus' sexuality. And you know, you get medieval monks writing about Jesus like he's a medieval monk. And then, you know, as culture changes, Jesus turns out to be kind of a nice person who's friendly and warm to little children. And then even in the 1960s, someone wrote a book proposing that Jesus was married. Okay, and Rosemary Ruther looks at all of these different options, and she says something that I agree with completely. If we really want to know what Jesus thought about sexuality, it seems to me that the main thing that he wanted to talk about was relationships between people, whether they are faithful, okay, whether they are loving, that there's not a lot of distinction between the different particular forms of doing that, but that the most important thing is the faithfulness, the love, the warmth, the acceptance, the grace. Now, I would favor, I mean, I think that it's perfectly appropriate for ordination committees and synods and so on to look at moral character, to inquire into theology, to inquire into all the things that go into making a minister. But there are many, and there are many gay and lesbian people whom I would not support for ordination, but there are also many heterosexual people, currently ordained and not ordained, whom I would not support for ordination. Okay? And I don't mean that as a low blow. I mean to say that when it comes to the overall Christian character and pastoral leadership qualities of a person, I just don't see that this one involuntary and potentially very faithfully used part of their character is a disqualifying matter.
Thank you for stating the positions. Now what I would like to do is open it up to the group, and I don't know that Dorothy or Robert either one have consented to become the authorities at which one directs all questions. Is that fair enough? But I think you certainly could direct a question to them. But I would suggest stating your position, if you have one, your concerns, your questions, either at panel members or in response to what someone else may say. I'll try to recognize people and try to get as many people in here as we can. And let's just see where this thing goes. Would anybody like to direct a question?
Yeah. I noticed that same text in Romans also condemns people who drink too much, and many seminaries encourage heavy drinking. Has the ELC or any other church ever considered asking all pastors to swear to abstinence in drinking alcohol before they're ordained? I think if we're going to talk about those things that are condemned by Romans, we also ought to add the other things that are explicitly condemned in the same text. Ask pastors not to be promiscuous and to promise to leave the parsonage as soon as they are, to stop drinking or smoking, and make sure that we have a perfectly sinless pastor. And if we're not ready to do that, then I would agree with the argument, why single out one particular example of sin? If we're going to be perfectly sinless, as the Cathari tried in the Middle Ages, we may not have many pastors, but at least they'd be models.
Anybody else? Thank you.
I'll go a step further from that. I think the church does have a right to be on the guard against sin, but I would say I would agree with you from my own experience. I haven't seen a homosexuality in itself is sinful. I mean, I think the church looks at sinful things at varying degrees. I mean, there are varying degrees of sinfulness. But I don't see how homosexuality in and of itself is sinful. I think many things, sinful things we may see occurring around homosexuality has a lot to do with how homosexuals have been treated in our society. Especially men are often pushed into very crazy lives, and this is not the majority of homosexuals, but some that become very prominent, where they may be, you know, forced to have, not forced, but encouraged by society to have many partners and never to seek a stable, loving, committed relationship. So if we are going to talk about, this is my opinion, if we are going to talk about ordaining homosexuals, we have to look for a way to encourage homosexuals to seek a committed, loving relationship as well. It has to be not just saying, well, it's okay, they can come in, it's a small sin. It has to be a positive step in saying homosexuality is not sinful in and of itself, and it is a sexual relationship. Church believes we have something to say about sexual relationships. We'd like to encourage you to have a good one.
There and then there.
Two questions, I think. First of all, to make sure I understand the position of the ELCA, is it the position that says someone can have homosexual orientation and be ordained as long as they are abstinent? And as long as they take a vow of abstinence, is that correct?
That is my understanding. My
question would then be, in terms of synodical call committees and who are doing the certification, is the same thing being asked of single heterosexuals?
Yes, it is. Yes. I just signed a paper. In fact, I'm seeking a call.
So it is being asked of both homosexuals?
Oh, yeah. It hasn't. Well, I don't think it has been an issue, but I think recently it has been pressed. The assumption has been that a single heterosexual is not sexually active.
But it was included in this paper, green paper, that I had to read and sign that I had to read it, and then the call committee questioned me about it. Yeah. That included heterosexual abstinence.
They didn't ask if you used styrofoam cups.
That's what said.
Go ahead.
The statement has been made about why lesbians, et cetera, are singled out. At a previous forum that took place here, one of the young men said, we have to do that because society discriminates against us. And I asked the question then, and I repeat it now, why are not we then having rights for adultery, fornication, all of the other things that are different forms of sexual behavior? We are taking...
Is that a point?
The point being, I believe that a person's sexual orientation is a private matter. And to put it forth in front of society as a challenge and say, you, society, must accept me for what I am, rather than me recognizing that I am a part of a total community, and if I intend to live in that community, and there are social mores that that community accepts, then I either accept them and try to live by them or live with the consequences.
Somebody.
I think you're assuming, though, that, I mean, that from what I understood, that homosexuals who admit it, come out of the closet, whatever term you want to use, are doing that as a test to society to say, look what I am, will you accept me for that? I think it's more a defense. I mean, I'm heterosexual, and you know, people know that, and it's no big deal. Well, I think it should be exactly the same way for heterosexuals. So if it's out in the open, they're not saying, come on, try me, test me. They're just saying, this is how I am, and that's the way it is. You know, and it's not like they're offering up their sexual orientation for discussion. They just want to be able to be that way, to be able to be accepted that way. So it's rather a defense, I think, when they ask for such things as, where I live just now, there was a big debate over whether city council should accept, I'm not exactly sure the word they used, but there was a lesbian and gay weekend, and the city council okayed it. There was an ad in the paper, and people really objected to that because they said, you're condoning a lifestyle. We're not condoning it. We're just recognizing that it's a natural lifestyle in the same way that heterosexuality is a natural lifestyle. I mean, two people, by getting married, are telling the rest of society that they're heterosexuals. In the same way, homosexuals want to get married and just be able to tell the rest of society, not that they're homosexual, but that they have that capacity to live in that particular kind of a loving relationship. So it's not a test of society.
I find it very interesting that you were able to pick up the Bible and had to finally put it down. There's so many references and to homosexuality in the Bible. The Bible is very explicit about what is sin and what isn't. And how far, the question comes back, do we want to bend? Should a practicing adulterer be ordained?
Should a practicing person who, say, they encourage alcoholism or drinking a lot at seminaries, should that be ordained? I mean, can we be selective about the passages we pick out today, 2,000 years later, and say, well, we're going to accept this one? You know, the first one said, thou shalt not commit adultery. Yet we have ordained divorce pastors. And can we be selective in the passages we choose?
Okay, let's see. Here and then here. Okay.
It seems to me we always hold up Paul saying, you know, how women don't have to keep their hair covered anymore. And we say, well, you know, it's real easy because that was cultural. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but we talk this fairly easily in our church, that that was a thing of the time. But then we say the reason that he was concerned about that was because of the tradition of the community around him. And even though as Christians we were free from the law, we didn't want to exploit that freedom and offend the community, which had people in it that we were wanting to reach with our good news. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes.
I'm not sure if this applies here. Do we want to apply something like that, apply that passage and say that this applies in the issue we're talking about tonight, or do we want to say, is the Holy Spirit leading us to be prophetic, to move in a new direction and accepting these children of God? To me, that's the issue, and I don't know the answer.
That's a nice statement of the issue, I think.
I guess, yeah. 2 points at the risk of maybe talking too much, but it seems to me a very basic cornerstone of Christianity that as Christians we've all accepted when we talk about sinfulness is that we are all inherently sinful. There are no non-sinful human beings. And I think we need to remember that. I think we also need to remember, at least within the Lutheran Church, and the call process, that when we look for a pastor, we are looking for someone who fits the particular and unique needs of each individual congregation and community. As such, if a homosexual is not right for that community, that particular community, the call committee and the congregation has every right to say no. This is not the right person to lead us. On the other hand, if that is something where it is not an issue or where other factors outweigh that, I would think that the individual congregation would also should have the right to say, yes, this is the person who is right to be our leader.
That is the position that's being taken by the congregations that intend to make the call, even if the ELCA rejects it.
At that point, it becomes a question of convenience and not the truth.
Depending on the truth, like I say, the basic truth that I understand is that we are all sinful. I have sinned. I have habits that in certain denominations would exclude me even from membership in the denominations. I am also forgiven by the grace of God. And as such, why pick out one, not the other? I disagree with the idea of relative sin. You sin or you don't sin.
There is an assumption, I think this should be said, that if a person is going to be a pastor within a congregation, that there are certain kinds of behaviors that are going to be expected. And were someone to persist, for example, somebody raised the question, what if a pastor was promiscuous? To persist in being promiscuous would mean that they would be removed from the clergy roster as a disciplinary. If they were to persist in an alcohol problem without getting treatment, they would be removed. If they were to persist in a mismanagement of funds and basically a life that was a total mess and an inability to lead, they would be removed. And to some extent, though this is hard to pin down, if they were to persist in being unloving and not helpful in their treatment of other human beings, they may be removed. So I think that although we all recognize that we're all sinful, there is a standard. I think the question, you know, to put back to the question, the issue is, I think really comes down to, is a practice of homosexual relationship, is that a sin or isn't it? There is certainly a significant a minority within the United States now that are saying, when you look at it, you have to come to the conclusion it is not. And that there are others that are saying, when you look at it, it is. And so I don't think the issue is whether there's going to be standards or not. I think the question, is this a sin, or is it a reflection of the brokenness of humanity? Or is it something that ought to be celebrated as good and an enriching expression in the human community? Would that be fair?
But now,
go ahead.
But then you've changed the question, because now if we decide to ordain practicing homosexuals, we are now endorsing homosexuality as not being sinful. And I think that's an enormous step. And if that's true, then I think that my position might well be different. If I'm willing to concede that we are all sinners, and this is a difficult sin to deal with, and there are practical questions, but if you ask me, should I endorse homosexuality or drunkenness, philandery, promiscuity, whatever you want, then I would be very, very reluctant, without a lot of consideration. You know, but that's changing the whole question, it seems to me.
Well, I hope I am not incorrect. I certainly am not authority, but it is my understanding that that's really the crux of the issue. You cross the Rubicon to ordain practicing homosexuals, because it seems to me the basis on which you cross is to say that as we've looked at it psychologically, sociologically, etc., this is not a sin if it is used in a loving and faithful way. And that's the crux of the issue.
But I think then that the question would be the same as we have for divorced pastors, which we now have in many cases where a pastor gets divorced and stays in the same congregation. And the question is he still effective after this? And that's a practical question. It's not a theoretical question, was he divorced? It's a question, is he still able to be an effective pastor? And I think the same thing would be true for a homosexual. Is his activity such as to cast doubt upon the church, which depends upon the congregation and area? Is his activity such as ruins him as being a pastor? And that's a totally different question from saying, do we endorse homosexuality as such, and indeed urge people to allow this? I think that's another question which is very, very difficult.
You've just done a beautiful job of introducing Peter Steinke right now. I think this is a great time, right? Well, Peter is involved in the counseling of clergy, and I think would have some insights in terms of practical implications just of what you raised. Is that?
Well, the church has for centuries already ordained homosexual clergy. The church for centuries has ordained practicing homosexuals. I have dealt with 5 homosexual clergy in my position in 8 years. One who is married also, bisexual. I know 2 others, and one of those is married. But to ordain a practicing homosexual, which I would say, fine, let's do it, but that gives a part answer to problem A. It doesn't deal with problem B, C, and D. Because problem B would be, ministry is an act of giving and receiving. And it's just not an act of giving. And you have to consider, would the community accept this person as that vehicle or that medium or whatever? And for a large percent of a church, that would not take place. There would be the homophobia, there would be the fear of AIDS, there would be all kinds of things that would be associated with that. That'd be problem B. Problem C is what I understand from the 5 gay males that I've dealt with. One of the biggest problems in the gay community is commitment. And this is what these individuals are coming to me primarily to talk about. It is so difficult to find that loving, faithful relationship in the gay community. So if that is true, you know, what kind of a model does this provide for other people in the community in terms of who this person is in the office? So those are problem B and C. I imagine I could think of problem D and E also down the line.
Those are all homosexual men?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I guess over the years, especially the last 8 years, I've become more tolerant. And I do react to the isolation of a particular manifestation of our brokenness. I have seen brokenness, and I have seen brokenness, and it has all kinds of manifestations. And I think there is also, we have to take into consideration that for all of us, there's a lot of fear in this. As a heterosexual, I can be very fearful of the homosexual and within my own self, because that is an orientation that is not mine. And as soon as you have a difference, you already have some kind of division of the house, or at least the possibility of the division of the house. So I've got to take a look at my own sexuality. Am I projecting something onto the gay community that I won't accept as part of myself? I don't know if this sheds any light, but this is my experience. It's just a lot of brokenness out there. And it's manifested in so many different ways. I really dislike isolating an aspect of it. I'll tell you, the gay clergy that I have dealt with are good pastors. I'm just telling you, I'm not trying to put a snow job on anyway. They're sensitive, they're competent, they're capable, they are good pastors. I had one who just left the parish and has taken another position in the church because he said, I am afraid now that I'm a practicing gay and his partner is a Roman Catholic priest, that if the young people in my church find out, it will just destroy them. I am making the choice to leave the parish. I just couldn't do that to those people. That's part of the sensitivity of this individual. That would be, you know, another problem down the line. Destroying faith, or, you know, you don't really destroy people's faith, but the disappointment you provoke for other people.
It seems to me like problem B, C, and D. Well, first of all, a lot of those same points were brought up with the question of ordaining women, that congregations would not be able to respond to them. And second of all, it seems like there are problems that come from the social aspects that Dorothy was talking about. They come from, and you brought this up too, the fears that the congregation has. There are things that the church has to decide one way or the other. And the stand they're taking now seems to be encouraging a lot of secrecy, which in turn brings about all these problems, the brokenness that you're talking about.
In recent months, I've come to see the problem in terms of being left-handed. Apparently, 10% of the human population is left-handed, and there's nothing they can do about trying to be right-handed. I mean, you try to force a kid who's left-handed to be right-handed, and she just, I mean, it just doesn't work. And there's been prejudice, too, through the ages against left-handed people. Not least, you know, in the tools that we provide for them. 10% of the human population, apparently, according to statistics, is gay or homosexual. That means of 400 people at Holden Village this week, 40 people among us are gay. And I just would hate to see the church hurting them any more than they have been hurt. Now I can see all kinds of terrible problems that have already been cited in dealing with that issue, but I do think it's going to have to be dealt with. And if I had to choose between a church that was always right but not always loving and a church that was always loving but not always right, I think I would choose the second. And the church's history has not always been in that direction. I mean, we've tried very much to be right on moral issues, and that has meant sometimes that we've been very unloving. And I would prefer a church that was loving even at the risk of being wrong.
Okay, I want to direct, you said you were a historian?
She is.
Okay, history question. Now, I mean, if we look at a question, this is just, I'm just picking a really easy sin, do not kill. Okay. I think we'd all raise our hands, do not kill is a sin. We look at that, we as Christians examine that and understand it historically as, what did they mean? What did this mean to Moses, to the Israelites, do not kill, when obviously they still had wars, you know, when they had capital punishment at times? What did do not kill mean? And so that we can better understand that, and of course, realizing the Holy Spirit may be leading us to a broader interpretation of that, of not killing even at war now. Okay, so that's a different situation. Looking back for homosexuality, what does Paul see when he says, do not be homosexual? Does he see people in loving relationships? Does he see people in abusing relationships? Like we said, there's a variety of these relationships. What does Paul view, do you think, historically, what is Paul looking at?
This is not really my field, but I'll make a quick response. Robin Scroggs, who teaches New Testament at Union Seminary in New York, has written a book called Homosexuality in the New Testament, in which he argues that Paul is referring to very specific practices, you know, in very specific pagan groups of men who were dealing with boys after a certain tradition, okay, and that Paul was really referring to a whole social world that was there. So he really contextualizes the condemnation. He says the condemnation was really specifically meant for that. But I know there's a lot more scholarship on this, which I'm not that familiar with. If you want to add anything, that's...
Only that I personally think Scroggs is dead wrong. but again, I mean, that only indicates that there are different meanings that can be given to these texts, mm-hmm. and that is a part of the problem. I do.
Is it time?
Yep. Go ahead.
All right.
I am struck by our willingness to understand grace as the acceptance of persons and the acceptance of a person's sin, and a forgiveness of that sin. And I do think that's a wonderful ingredient of the biblical idea of grace, and it resounds in the Lutheran tradition. However, it would have been unthinkable for Paul to conceive of grace in that way. For Paul, grace was transforming power. The marks of God's grace were made visible in changes that people made. So that for Paul, it wasn't that the community of faith was old creatures, but new old passing away, new becoming. It's striking that the book of Revelation ends the Christian biblical canon in a garden, even where it begins. And there in that garden, there is a community of transformed persons. Is there a way then that we can think about grace as that which empowers and enables repentance? That which empowers and enables persons to change from that which is not good, from that which is good. There might be a paradigm, and I recognize, I know the statistics of persons who have changed their sexual orientation. It presumably is as difficult for a homosexual to become a heterosexual as it is for a heterosexual to become a homosexual. But Paul reminds us in that text in 1 Corinthians 6 that after listing these various vices, which include drunkenness and thievery and other things, he says, such as were some of you, but you have been washed and justified and sanctified. That is, the transforming power of grace changes persons. And perhaps that is another dimension to this discussion, to this debate that we can consider. Grace is not only acceptance, but grace is the very real power of God which changes persons into the very sorts of persons that God intends.
I promised Dorothy I would give her a chance to respond, but can I hear, and I'm sorry, I have there have been hands out back here. I haven't seen that. There was a foot there. Here and then.
Okay. My question is, where does sexuality in general begin, and where does it end? Does it end and begin in a specific act? And if so, what does that have to say for homosexuality?
Would anybody like to address that?
As of the early 70s, I was working with a doctor who was trying to pinpoint the point at which sexual differentiation occurred in embryos. And they still didn't.
A little louder?
They worked with a gentleman who was trying to pinpoint when gender was decided embryonically. And as of 1971, they still really didn't know. They still really could not pinpoint that. I don't know if that's changed, but everything I've heard since suggests that orientations, for whatever cultural influences there are, environmental factors, personal factors, may go well beyond birth, back towards conception. This is not known, and one could have great debate over this. And so this question of whether or not homosexuality is a sin can be taken back to the point of conception and say, well, was it sinful that one gene flipped one way instead of another? And so then, is homosexuality a natural part of creation? That's a real tough one, because you can't place a value judgment on that one. That's biological, and we don't know.
But I think it is the first 6 weeks we are neuter. And the sex characteristics do not show up until after 6 weeks.
In the embryo.
I think he's talking about sexual orientation, not gender, right?
Gender. You know, gender is one thing. Is sexual orientation part of that? I don't know.
Okay, one question up here. Dorothy wanted to say something, and maybe we'll officially call it a night, because I think we want to keep these within an hour. Is that understood? Yeah. And then if people want to stick around and do more discussing, that's fine, but.
I guess I'd like to start with by saying that I'm not a follower of Paul, I'm a follower of Jesus. And in the Jesus community, I see that there are many marginalized people that who were his followers. And I would much rather call myself a part of the Jesus community than a Christian. I don't see the Christian as a faith that has subscribed to the life of Jesus. At the risk of once again being a token lesbian in the Holden community, I would say that grace has led me to who I am, and for me to go against that would be to go against the will of God. Now, I think that grace has transformed me already, and if she's going to do it again, she's really going to be messing me up. To lead me to who I am has been a very empowering thing. So does the Holy Spirit, what does she do when she leads people home? Is she fooling them time and time again? I hope not. I guess that's all I'd want to say.
I have one thing I'd like to say, is that we are enjoined to love one another. But as a gathered community, as a group of people, we are always in need of earthly governance. There's the spiritual governance and the earthly governance. We have standards set for our spiritual governance, and we have standards set for our earthly one. And as these standards have been set through custom and through time, so that a body of people can live together in relative harmony and peace, the person who does not choose to work within that standard is not considered a person to be a leader of that particular group of people. And I do feel that sexual orientation is a one factor in the human condition, which we are now open to consider when we choose leaders. And it has nothing to do with whether we love that person or we don't love that person. But we have to think in terms of who do we, in the congregational life. The congregational life is made up of older people, middle-aged people, young people trying to establish families, and children. What do we want to see in the collective congregation? Yes, there is tremendous diversity, but we need a leader. We need a leader for our prayer life, we need a leader for our home life, and I do feel that it comes down to what we would like to see, the person who most represents the ideal of the standard that we have collectively chosen to try to live by. None of us ever live to the standard that we hold in front of us, but we're trying. And so I think that it has nothing to do with whether we love or we don't love when we're choosing a leader. We need somebody who represents to us that love, but who adheres to the standard as we understand it.
I think this one could go on for a long time, but I'm going to call it, but I thank you for the very considerate discussion. And I appreciate Peter and Dorothy and Rob, your willingness to share with us and everyone here. And hopefully this dialogue can continue, because I think these are obviously very, very important things. And this is an issue that has come to fore now, and this time in history probably hasn't before in the same way. We want to meet it well. Thank you very much.